But I want to thank Rabbi Eisenberg for giving this opportunity. Thank you for coming out on a cold Monday evening in the middle of January, end of January. Thanks to the members of my shul that came out. That's true dedication. You get discount off your membership in my shul if you come to my shiurim outside. So I want to do something a little bit different tonight. The year before I came to Chicago, I had a number of opportunities, a number of different positions that I was applying for. I knew I wanted to stay in the rabbinate. I was working in Teaneck at the time, and I could stay in Teaneck or I could have gone a number of places. Chicago was one of them, or my Brandon and I grew up together. Florida, Memphis, South Carolina. There were different interviews that I went on. And when you go on interviews, I'm sure many of you have served on rabbinic search committees. There's a lot of questions you have to ask the rabbi, some of which they have no answer, some of which you're just trying to catch him so that later when he's your rabbi, you can say, oh, you promised us this 25 years ago. I wrote it down. One job interview I once went on, they asked me why I was leaving Teaneck. I had a good job. Why was I leaving? So I knew I didn't want that job, so I told them because I was getting fired. So then I said, I was just joking. I wasn't getting fired, but you have to have a little bit of fun also in the interview. But everybody wants to know, how much of a Zionist are you? Maybe they saw my black yarmulke. They figure you know what, you're a Zionist. So they would ask me what's the level of Zionism that I believe in. So they didn't ask me, what do you believe in? What's your religious Zionism? What did they ask me? Come on, what did they ask me to know? No, not that you say halal in Yom HaTzmud.
You're not in Israel.
They say, do you say hallel with a bracha on Yom HaTzmud?
Wow.
That's it. And if you said that, you asked me that also? If you said that, you knew you were religious Zionist. So I'm not going to talk about Yom HaTzmud, and I'm not going to talk about hallel with a bracha or not with a bracha. Maybe at the end I'll come back to it. But I want to talk about way before Yom HaTzmud. I want to talk about Zionism, and I want to talk about especially Messianism. The idea of Mashiach. I will do it in three parts. Don't worry about how long the Ma'amar Kumash sheets are. I'm not going to read through a lot of them. If you want to look it on your own later, that'd be great. I'll do it in three parts. I'm actually going to talk about anti-Zionism. I know, that's not usually the topic you would give in a religious Zionism shiur. The anti-Zionists, the pro-Zionists, and where that leaves us today. Now, when we hear anti-Zionists today, what do you think of when you hear of anti-Zionists? Niturei Karta, right? Oh, so I'm not even going to get into Niturei Karta. I'm going to show you that, in fact, Niturei Karta probably stems from this, but I'm not even going to quote any of the things from Satmar. But I want to show you that the argument over Zionism in the beginning, way back, way before 1948, had nothing to do with the state of Israel. There was no state. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, you actually had people that were making Aliyah. You had the Bilu movement, right? Beis Yaakov L'chuven Elcha, okay? You had, if you ever say V'yitzen Lecha, so some shuls got rid of V'yitzen Lecha, like ours, for good reasons, but it's a good tefillah. The first time I ever said V'yitzen Lecha, I realized, oh, that's where Bilu comes, with the Bilu movement, Rishon LeZion. These are major, major political and religious, at least religious in the belief in Israel, moving to Israel, settling the land, and everybody's up in arms. So I, to get your blood boiling, just so like it keeps you awake at 8 o'clock at night, so let me share with you just a little bit. If you looked at page 2, and I'm not even going to touch the Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, okay? So let's just start. There's a lot of venom towards the Zionists in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And in fact, there's a pamphlet that is published called the Or LeYesharim. That is in the top right, that's the actual pamphlet. And in this pamphlet are some quotes from Gedolim of the time. Right? Major, major rabbinic figures. Rabbinic figures in the late 1800s, early 1900s were real rabbinic figures. They were leading Eastern European Jewry. And for all intents and purposes, most of European Jewry followed them for halacha, for guidance, for everything. And yet when it comes to Zionism, and it comes to people moving to Israel, they're very angry with them. Now, why are they angry at them? They're not angry at them because they're making Aliyah. That's fine, you should go to Israel. Although, according to some, you should only go to Israel, we'll see. If you can really, really hold all the mitzvahs there. Why were they angry at them? Because when they were making Aliyah, what were they saying? Look at us. We're moving to Israel. What are we doing? What are we doing? We're bringing the Mashiach. We're settling the land. We are part of the redemption. So if you look at the top left, for example, Rav Yaakov Shapiro was the Rav of Grodno. He writes, just read this without, don't read it the 2017. We're going to go all the way back to the late, early 1900s. For I know the devastation they are wreaking upon the congregation of Israel. My heart sinks within me, my eyes grow dark, my ears wax heavy at what is being done and said. Their valor in the land is not for the sake of the true faith, nor is it for this that they wave their banners. What sort of nation can have it if they throw off our holy land and its precepts? Why, if you look at the bottom, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe also writes, it's underlined, he says, you can't listen to them. Abraham, you can't listen to these Zionists. Don't listen to them. It's bad. It's bad. Where is this coming from? Why are they so angry? So, by the way, I'm just going to tell you something. I don't believe this part. This is not, the whole shiur is not going to be this. Okay? I'm smarter than that. Okay? So just to go one more step, if you turn the page, I'm not, if you look at the, also from the Oral Yesharim, it quotes Reb Chaim of Brisk. If you go to any yeshiva, you're going to learn Reb Chaim of Brisk, one of the greatest, greatest minds to have lived in the last few hundred years. And yet, when it comes to Zionism, in that underline he says, La'akor Yesode Hadas. What are these people doing? They're uprooting religion. They're uprooting what we believe in. How is that? What did you say? So I'm going to tell you, don't say Chas V'Sholom yet. I want to show you, at least a little bit, where this is coming from. Now, when we hear the word Zionist today, and when they hear the word Zionist, there's two different things. So what's the issue? What were they bothered about? Okay? And what I'm going to show you over the next little bit is that this debate can go one of two ways. The anti-Zionists are going to look at it in one way, and the pro-Zionists, Reb Kook, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, the Rav, are going to take it completely the opposite way. What were they upset about? So they're upset about three things, only one of which I'll focus on. The first thing they were upset about is in Source 3, which I won't even read inside, but the Gemara already says that there were people that tried to make Aliyah earlier in history. What happened to them? They died. Who were they? The Gemara says the people that Yechezkel revived were who? The Bnei Ephraim. The Bnei Ephraim tried to do what in Egypt? Make Aliyah. And what happened to them? Didn't work out so well. Number two is, I'm sure something somebody has for sure spoken about in the 19 lectures, is the idea of the three oaths that the Gemara writes in the end of Ksuvos. There are three oaths. Okay? Now, you could throw everything at, doesn't apply, this, that, correct. But there is a Gemara. The Gemara says one of the three oaths is, you can't make Aliyah en masse. So you could argue there wasn't a mass, the Balfour decorate. Great, I will give a whole shiur about that. But it's a Gemara, like any other Gemara. Okay, but the final thing, and this is what I want to talk about, how does redemption happen? So I have the opportunity to teach at Hillel Torah also. I teach 7th and 8th grades. And I allow my students once in a while to have a question and answer day. Now, usually they want it because they just don't want to learn. So they come in, Rabbi Lisa, we have a question to answer. They say, sure, what questions do you have? We don't know. So that's not going to work. Okay? But one thing they're fascinated about is Mashiach. How's Mashiach going to come? What's he going to look like? How are we going to know? All of these things. Now, the real answer is, we have no idea. Okay? But we think we know. When the Rambam says, we try to know. Oh, how's it going to happen? How are we going to be sitting here? We're going to be learning. And all of a sudden, we're going to be redeemed? How's it going to work? Now we know that the days of Mashiach, the whole 1,000 years most likely of the Yemos HaMashiach, will be probably, according to the Rambam, we'll be living in Chicago, but we'll have the Mashiach. And there'll be peace in the world, it'll be great. What are we going to know? How are we going to know? So there's two versions. The first version, and this is why it's important, look at source number 5. Source number 5 comes from a pasuk in Malachi. A pasuk in Malachi says the following. Source 5, Hinani Sholeach Malachi, I'm going to send a messenger, Upina Derech Lifanai, and he's going to clear the way before me. What's the next word? Upitom, what does that mean? And suddenly, all of a sudden we're going to be shopping in Jewel, we're going to be watching the game, we're watching the Super Bowl, not the Super Bowl, well, wait till after we're done, then we'll go. Okay, but we're going to be there, and all of a sudden, Mashiach going to come, done! And then we're going to be there. All of a sudden, it'll be there just like that. So many rabbis in the early 1900s, the late 1800s, viewed messianism and redemption based on this pasuk. Which means the redemption doesn't happen, we'll do a little bit here, we'll do a little bit there. Like, it's very Jewish. That sounds very Jewish. No, we'll do, and all, we'll live our lives, and all of a sudden, when we're ready, and God says, you're ready, what's going to happen? Boom, it's going to be done. That's how they viewed redemption and Mashiach. This is not getting into any of the issues that some of the Zionists were secular. Maybe at the end, it doesn't do with that. This has to do simply with redemption. That these people were making Aliyah, they were settling the land, they were working on the kibbutz, and what were they saying? We're bringing the Mashiach. We got him. We're helping along the way. And these rabbis said, absolutely not. That's heresy. Can't say that. So what I share with you at the bottom is a beautiful recap. There is a great book. If you want more about this topic, and now that you're getting like angry at me that I even quoted this, okay? I know you are. You're like, I can't believe we have a modern Orthodox rabbi in Chicago that would even think such things, right? I can't believe Rabbi Engel thought of this. It's crazy. Listen to this, okay? What? Messianism, that's a true Chicagoan. You for sure, right? There you go. Messianism is a great book by Avi Arvitsky. It's not that old, the last 10 years. It's on this topic, and he has a whole section on radical, he calls radical anti-Zionism. And in fact, at the end he talks about the Satmar, but he writes the following. What was their belief? So it comprehends messianism in miraculous and supernatural terms rather than concrete political terms. It yearns for a transcendent redemption that arrives all at once. That's the pasuk in Malachi. Rather than a gradual redemption whose light draws little by little, which we'll talk about in a moment. By the same token, it makes redemption dependent upon repentance. What happened to that? A number of years ago in my shul, I gave a whole shavuos on Mashiach. Hey, and there's two ways Mashiach can come. But the easiest way Mashiach can come is
redemption.
We did it. We earned it. Okay, and if we earn it, God's going to give it to us right away. If we don't earn it, he's going to have to punish us. How in the world, these rabbis said, could you even think of suggesting there's a possibility that you non-religious, non-affiliated, Michal Shabbos, are bringing the redemption? That's not what we believe. That's not what we believe. Okay? It makes you dependent upon repentance and preparation, exclusively spiritual nature detached from all mundane human activity. Consequently, it favors traditional quietism and historical passivity, which basically means don't do anything. You sit back, you go to the store in the morning, you come home, you go to the basement at night, and when God thinks we're ready, we'll get redeemed. As opposed to the attitude we'll see that permits certain kinds of activism, and when it comes to the question of the Holy Land, the conflict between its powerful attraction and the fear of not living up to the severe religious demands entailed in dwelling there, this view gives greater weight to the fear. Okay? To make matters even worse, I'm going to tell you something. Who are they yelling at? They're not just yelling against the Zionists. I'm going to let you on a secret. They're upset at the Zionists. They're also upset at a small organization called the Aguda. The Aguda, yeah, they might have worn black hats and had beards, but they also believed in settling the land, and they were influential in helping some people settle the land. And these radical anti-Zionists felt, that's the only time, by the way, Zionists and Agudanics are like going to put into the same bubble. It's good. Okay? Who are you? And they got very angry at them. So for the interest of time, I'm going to skip source 7 and 8. This just shows you the fear that these Rabbanim had. And this really has nothing to do with the state of Israel and Medinat Yisrael. We're 50 years away from that. This is for the first time, really, nationally. You had Shabtai Tzvi and Bar Kokhba throughout history. But nationally, this was really the first time that any group had ever really said, we did it, we got it. Our Shabtai Tzvi created a nice buzz, and it was fun, but he was a wacko. And he ended up, you know, being married to who knows what, and he was in prison. And that died down. And we didn't leave, we sold our homes, and we minted coins, but we didn't move to Israel. This was nationally the first time you had people moving, settling, and believing, this is us. We did it. We got the redemption. We're on our way. And they said, how could you say that? Pitom Yavo. It's not Pitom Yavo. Where's your tshuva? They got very, very angry. So if you look to even towards the bottom, I share with you just one more snippet. The last paragraph on page 5 from Mervitsky. Shapiro challenged under the leadership of the Zionist movement. He contemporary Orthodox leadership. His wrath was primarily directed against Agudat Yisrael, the more middle of the road Haredi group that settled strictly observant Jews in Eretz Yisrael. These anti-Zionists were upset at even religious Jews settling there. Nobody can settle there. Unless maybe you go there because you had nowhere else to go, but don't go there and settle and work and believe that we're doing something. Stay here, stay back, don't do anything, wait till Mashiach redeems you. Now. So what do you say about that? Things didn't work out so great. So we'll talk about that at the end. But I'm showing you purely from a perspective of messianism, of how we earn ultimate redemption in the end of times. We never really in history ever had to grapple with this question. 2,500 years, we're running from Italy to England to Spain to France to Germany, every country we're in, we're getting kicked out of. And now there is an inkling that maybe we have a homeland and we're settling, which means if we have a land of Israel, you know what else we could do? Maybe it's going to be maybe we could build the Beis HaMikdash soon. But this is beginning to change. And this was very exciting for some and a very dangerous reality for many. That's where this comes down to. Now, what about the pro-Zionists? What about those that didn't believe that? So you have to figure out all of these issues. You have to figure out the Gimel Shavuos. All right, we'll figure that out. It's not a problem. And you have to figure out, we're not forcing the end. We're good. What about this? What about this? How do we view redemption? So let me share with you the other source about redemption, and that's in source number 10. And I'm just going to share with you one line in the bold. One line. That's the following. Ulekach herech HaKadosh Baruch Hu apo am Yisrael shalotir dam megava. He angered them slowly because the way that will be redeemed is two words. Those two words are kima, kima. What does kima, kima mean? A little bit at a time. So what you basically have is two forms of redemption. And by the way, when it comes to everything in Judaism is two things, right? It works two ways. You have this also, there's two ways we can give you Mashiach. There's two ways that the third Beis HaMikdash will be built. Either, one version has it, it's going to drop out of the sky. Done, ready to go. One version is, we're going to build it. So it's probably dependent on whether we did Tshuva, whether we were punished to get to that point. But redemption is going to happen a little bit at a time. So how do I know when a little bit at a time is? No one's telling me that. No one's guiding me. There's no Navi anymore. There's no nobody in Poland telling me what the right thing to do is. So we have to figure it out. So while many, including some of the greatest rabbis that lived in those times, looked at this and said, this isn't just wrong, it's heretically wrong. It's evil. Those that are settling are evil. You're doing bad things. The opposite camp, you're doing amazing things. This is absolutely the right way to do it. Why? How many times do I have to be hit over the head to tell me to move to the land of Israel, to settle it, and to be involved in the process? So now, let me show you the opposite approach, and this we'll spend more time on. You first have, let me skip to page 7, because this, there's probably no better source than either Rav Kalischer or Rav Kook. So Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who lives from 1795 to 1874, he was the rabbi's rabbi. You wanted him as your rabbi. You know why? Because unlike every other rabbi, he didn't take any money. He traveled around and would not take any expenses for anything. Right? No officiating anything. You didn't pay him for a contract. That's a community's goal, right? That's what we got to institute. Not only that, he didn't have a lot of money. His wife made a little bit of money. That's all they really had. And he traveled around. He would travel around actually asking for donors to donate to the establishment of the land of Israel and different yeshuvim and different communities. Why did he do that? Because he declared in 1882. In 1882 he declares, I'm sorry, or 62 he declares, here's what we have to do. We have to settle the land. Not only that, if we don't do it, we're missing out on something. Redemption and geula is dependent upon us. Okay? And I'm just gonna read for you, it's such beautiful language from a Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. He writes for in his sefer called the Drishat Zion. So look at the top in the bold. Gulat Yisrael, the redemption of Jewish people, asher nachnu chochim, and we're all waiting for. Al yachshov, don't think. Ki pitom yered Hashem yisbarach. Why would he use the word pitom? Because that's the pasuk. Don't think that it's just going to happen. Right? That lemor la'amotzu, there is going to be told, right? It would be a mass email in the morning. Everybody go. Oh, Yishlach Meshicho Karegim Hashemayim Mitkor B'Shofar Gadol Nitche Yisrael. All of a sudden, it's going to be a big shofar. Done, and we're going to be gathered together. Absolutely not. Look at the bottom of this paragraph, the top. Ki Me'at Me'at Tavo Gulas Yisrael. What has to happen? It's got to be a little bit at a time. La'at La'at Hatzmiach Keren Yeshua. A little bit, we'll begin to see the redemption. Ad Yisrael Yasachayo V'yizgim Me'od B'achar Yusuf B'koyim Kol Yehud. Eventually, we'll work at it. And he says in the next line, V'fianiyos Da'ati, according to, based on my humble opinion, Tebi Yishuv Eretzo Pitzichas HaShar L'Geulah HaShalema. When you read these works, they don't waste any words. Listen to what he writes again. It's the Pitzichas HaShar L'Geulah HaShalema. That can't be farther from the end. We're going to be like maybe open a gate that might do something for another gate, right? But you know what it's doing at least? It's opening something. And we got to open something. Ma'at tavo gulas Yisrael. A little bit will come. La'at la'at. Wait, what? Have you ever been to Israel? What are we all saying? La'at la'at. Okay, they don't drive like that, right? But we say la'at la'at. So from Tzvi Herz Kosher in the early, late 1800s, this is not Medina. There's no 1948 right now. There's no United Nations vote. But he saw that there's something happening. And for the first time in 2,500 years, we could get people back to Israel to settle communities, not like random people that, you know, ended up there, or, you know, the Rav Yehuda Halevi who wants to go there, the Vilna. No, communities can go. How in the world? First of all, you can't say they shouldn't go. They should go. That's redemption. How in the world are you going to say, nah, that's not redemption? And in fact, he's even agreeing. He says, I don't think it's redemption. You don't hear me saying the Mashiach's here, but you hear me saying, maybe this will do something that might do something that eventually might bring something close to the bring of Mashiach. But I'll take it. I'll take it. And he writes at the bottom, which this is in the 1800s. He writes, Reishis HaGi'ula. How's it going to happen? All right, so he's pushing it and he's asking for money. He's making parlor meetings. Reishis HaGi'ula, Idehiso Rus Rach Nidivim. What is it going to take? Donations. Vaidei Rotzor HaMalchios. Lekabetz Ma'at Minei Bzurei Yisrael Ad Mas Kodesh. And what's it going to take? Some real courageous people that are going to do what? This is not 1920 and 1931 and 1938. This is the middle 1800s. You have to leave it all because we have an opportunity to go. Drop it. You're the beginning of something. And that's the other version of redemption. Pitom, something might be Pitom the Beit. I mean, there might be Pitom, whatever it is. We have, you know what's going to be Pitom? That eventually, if we keep working and working and working, you know what's going to happen? The Mashiach is going to come, and they'll be, wow, we came, and we're amazed. That's going to be suddenly. But it's not suddenly not to do anything and not to be involved. So I share with you over the next pages, from different perspectives, not just from a Mashiach perspective. Yeah, obviously you have Rav Kook, so you can't, you can't give a religious Zionist shir and not quote Rav Kook, or the whole time. I just spoke, I remember Gutzin's going to talk about the Nitziv, so I just spoke at Shal Shudas on my show about the Volozhin Yeshiva, that Rav Kook in Volozhin, the legend has it, was there for 1 year, okay, and finished Shas 40 times. That's really good. That's not just Daf Yomi, that's Rav Kook. Rav Kook was not just a brilliant thinker and leader and philosopher and Zionist in many ways, and the founder of religious Zionism. You first and foremost, was Talmud Chacham. So Rav Kook writes the following: nothing in our faith, either in its larger principles or in its details, negates the idea that we can begin to shake off. Again, what does that mean? It's not saying we got it. It's saying I can begin to shake off. What do you mean shake off? When you shake something off, do you get it off completely? No. But it's something. Okay? the dust of our exile by our own efforts through natural historical processes. That we have sacred duty to try to do whatever means at our disposal. We cannot hope for the salvation except through palpable miracles. But you better believe that if we have an opportunity to do anything, we better do it. This is not the shiur for discussion of tefillah, for the tefillah of the Medina we make every week in Shul. But that debate of a Reishis Smichas Gulosenu is this debate. It's this debate. Reishis Smichas Gulosenu is a debate about messianism or not messianism. There are some shuls that will say Shetiyei Reishis Smichas. I think it should be. Right? You know the most famous rabbi not to say Reishis Smichas Gulosenu was? Took it out? It'll blow your minds. You'd be like, no way. You're going to Google it afterwards. You're not going to believe me. Rabbi Lamb. Whoa, Rabbi Lamb. He was the head of modern orthodoxy. Yeah. But he felt, in many ways, it was heretical. And it was heresy. So Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who is a rabbi of mine, tells us that he becomes the rabbi in the Jewish center. So he would like to start saying, Reishis Smichas Gulosenu. So I had opportunity to, as a shul rabbi, to have my rabbi emeritus in the shul with me. So when you have a rabbi emeritus in the shul with you, in many ways it's a schus, because you get critiqued all the time. All the time. Rabbi Frank, all Hashem, used to tell me after my drushas, he used to give me pointers. One time after, if you know Rabbi Frank, who was involved in the Jewish community at every moment and never stopped learning, one Rosh Hashanah, I've corrected my Baal Tokeah on Rosh Hashanah in 8 years one time. And that one time, I came down after the last tekios. Rabbi Frank comes over to me, gives me a shkoyach on the drashos, and he goes, Rabbi, did you ever blow shofar on your own? A few times. He goes, I could tell. Right? So you get criticized. So Rabbi Schachter says he wants to institute Reishis Smichas Gulosenu, but Rabbi Lamb is sitting there. And the whole, if you've ever been to the Jewish Center, it's not like a shack. It's the Jewish Center in Manhattan. And Rabbi Lamb, in his humility, said, it's your shul. You do what you want. It's your policy. And so Rabbi Schachter instituted Reishis Smichas. But that's his debate. You know, sometimes people don't say Reishis Smichas. Doesn't mean they're not a Zionist. That's a question of messianism. And that's what Rav Kook says. We have to try. And he writes in the next, in a row, the redemption is continuous. This is a long run. We're working at it. And we go a little bit forward, or we go a little bit backwards, and we're trying. Let me share with you one more from Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Tzvi Yehuda writes, the son of Rav Kook, how is it that the movement for a concrete redemption in our time, including the settlement and the conquest of the land of Israel, and the abandonment of the abolition of exilic existence, meaning how is it that we got rid of it all and we're here, did not originate with the religious? How is it that some religious spokesmen even withheld their support of Zionism and the movement for redemption? They failed to recognize that it was not that we mortals were forcing the end, this is amazing, but rather the master of the universe, lord of the universe, was forcing our hand. That it was not human voices that broke down the wall separating us from our land, but the voice of the living God calling upon us, go up. Rav Tzvi Yehuda flips it on its head. I didn't share with you here, but I'm sure at some share in the past you've discussed in this series the six knocks of Rabbi Soloveitchik. The Rav, in his famous speech, which is now this amazing essay of Kol Dodi Dofeik, talks about the six knocks, right? For the establishment of the State of Israel. How could you not believe anymore in the establishment of the State of Israel after all of these things that had to work out? And how the world completely, the Rav famously said that the UN has done nothing except give them the State of Israel, right? And still true today. The fact that all of that worked in its favor, that's God knocking on the door. That Ritzvi Yehuda says, they were looking at it, we're sitting back, we can't touch anything. What do you mean? God's forcing you, do something. I'm giving you a land of Israel. I'm forcing you to go there. There is one more opinion, by the way, that's in the middle. And that comes from the greater... This opinion in the middle of Rhines is a little bit in the middle. I'll tell you why, because he sort of separates these two. He Rhines had a yeshiva. He lived in Poland, and he had a yeshiva. His yeshiva was called Torah Vadas. You've heard of Torah Vadas? Not that one. He originally had a yeshiva called Torah Vadas, and in that yeshiva, Torah Vadas, he actually advocated for Torah and Mada. Yeah, not now. So that was that lasted for 12 years until the breakout of World War I. You can read what he writes at the bottom. He was a little bit in the middle. And even Rav Kook's major philosophy, and I even share with you on the next page, but just as taking that, Rav Kook also does not believe that this was the be-all and the end-all. Of course, you need religious observance and mitzvah and all of that. You need that. You don't have that in Israel. That's not redemption. Rav Kook's genius was that he felt that the secularists were the beginning. They were the ones who were telling us, hey, you frummies, get over here. But if we didn't get over there, the redemption couldn't happen just to the secularists. That's when Rav Kook was asked to give a eulogy in 1904 for Herzog. So they asked him to give a eulogy. He's caught off guard. He was the Rav of Yaffa at the time. He's caught off guard. Why is he caught off guard? He doesn't know what to do. On the one hand, how can you not give a eulogy for Herzog? On the other hand, how could you give a eulogy for Herzog? Right? He wasn't so committed, but... Herzl. What did I say? Herzl. So on the one hand, founder of Zionism, right? On the other hand, not so Jewish anymore. You're not so from. So he decides, because Rav Kook was an Ohev Yisrael, he'll give it, but I'm not going to mention him by name. And it's in this eulogy that he talks about sort of the guf and the neshama that work together. If we're giving a shir on guf and neshama, we could talk about this beautiful eulogy. But in his way, Rav Kook was talking about that they work together. The secularists obviously provided the guf, but you need the neshama, you need the religious part of Zionism to come along. And what this does, by the way, for the first time in the history of really of Judaism and philosophy, was completely shift what it means to have a Mashiach. Because now, there isn't a Mashiach that we're waiting for. Look what I share with you on page 9. It's in the second sentence. In these circles, as distinct from those of the present generation, the Lubavitcher Hasidim, immediate religious expectation does not center on a personal Messiah. Without abandoning traditional beliefs, attention is focused in a new way on the realm of collective history. One seeks the signs of divine providence amidst the contemporary events in the life of the nation. Used to be, we sat back in the shtetl and we waited for a miracle, for something miraculous. Ah, now I know, Mashiach's here. But now, it's different. Now, I can say, you know what? There's an opening for redemption. Maybe we should go, maybe we should settle. We're part of that process. We're not the Mashiach, but we're part of it. One who seeks the signs of divine providence amidst temporary events in the life of the nation. Got to listen to the following. This is great. Is this divine dynamic that is a messianic process, right? Rabbi Aviner, the great Aviner, living in Israel today. Rabbi Beitel, the dean of a Terekon Meshiva in the Muslim court of Jerusalem. The messianic process is a concrete divine reality. The action upon history of a powerful redeemer of the rock of Israel who lives within history. This is great. He continued with undisguised irony. If someone whispers in your ear that he has not seen the Mashiach lately, either in the fields of the Golan or the expanse of the Sinai, by Israel in the Six-Day War, he may be an honest man. But if he goes a step further and says, since I have not seen it, it does not exist, his words are of falsehood and seduction. Say to him, you may not have seen it, but others have. We declare with absolute certainty of our imminent redemption. Imminent redemption, not redemption. Imminent redemption. All the troubles, delays, complications we have endured are merely momentary and cannot obscure this mighty overall trend, this Messiah, whose power has been concealed since ancient times in the treasure house of history, who is now being revealed in actuality. The Messiah is a metaphor for the messianic idea and messianic age. So what I wanted to show you before I end with where does this leave us today? Is the debate over Zionism in the late 1800s, early 1900s, is not necessarily focused on our, like, you go to AIPAC today, right, and there's the Ture Karta, and you're yelling at them, they're yelling, they have no idea what they're talking about anyway. They're just yelling, they're hired to yell. And that wasn't the debate. This was a debate centered on Mashiach. How involved are we in redemption? How much of a role should we play in redemption? And how do we view that role? So some viewed it as, absolutely not, take a step back, and they have their source, in a pasuk in Malachi and in the Gemaras, and others view it as absolutely get involved. God telling you to get involved, and they have their sources in Psukim and in Navi. So let me end with two facts. Where does it leave us today? So this is all great. It's a nice discussion. We go home. We can talk about it. We can like Kim and Rabbi Lita quoted those sources. Those are crazy. Okay, we're never going to go to another share of his ever again. Okay, but that's all fun. That was all fun and good until the Holocaust. And once you have the Shoah and the juxtaposition and the connection and the proximity of the state of Israel to the decimation in Europe, it's a whole new discussion. So let me share two concluding thoughts on this idea of Messianism and Zionism. You know what I believe? I have no idea. I have no idea. I know that it's not ultimate redemption. And I know, like Rav Kook says, that we have to be involved. That's what I believe. And the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, takes it one more step. And I quote it here, I'm going to tell it to you all outside except for one paragraph. The Rav has a number of speeches he gave about the land of Israel. And in one of these lectures, he talks about Yosef and the brothers. Now, we know the story. The brothers are there. Yosef is loved clearly more. Right? He just walked home from Shul this past Shabbos. So I have five boys and a girl. Okay? I just had a girl in the past summer. So I'm walking with three of my boys, and two of them are next to me, one's in front of me, and I said out loud, "Oh, my two favorites are right next to me." Right? Just so you know, get them going. Right? Okay? You can give me parenting tips later. But Yosef is loved clearly more. And not only is he loved, he has dreams that show that he's what? Loved more than the brothers. And what does he do with them? What does he do with those dreams? Tells them. You ever been to the movie theater and there's always that person in the movie theater who's doing what during the movie? Yelling at the screen, "Don't go in there! Don't you know?" Right? So when you're reading those parashos and those stories, you're saying to yourself every year, right? "Yo, come on, Yosef, don't do it!" Maybe this year will be different. He won't tell them, right? Who knows? And every year he tells them. So you can think of a lot of that. I've never found in my limited research a more beautiful answer than the Rav suggests. The Rav says Yosef wasn't trying to be better than everybody else. What's Yosef called? A tzaddik. I just learned Navi with my students about a tzaddik. So I asked them. I give them all whiteboards, little whiteboards, and an expo marker. I say, "Draw for me what a tzaddik looks like." Everybody drew. One kid drew a tzaddi. He's brilliant, okay? But everybody else drew a picture with what? A long white beard. I told him that tzaddik doesn't mean to learn all day with a beard. Tzaddik means to do the right thing, right? To be a good person. Then I made them on the spot make skits. Ever see 13 eighth grade boys try to put on skits about what it means to be a tzaddik? It was entertaining. So Yosef's a tzaddik. No tzaddik. You wouldn't ever say about somebody who says, "I'm better than you." Yeah, that's a tzaddik. Right? So why does Yosef tell his brothers? Because the brothers are there and they're living and they think everything is great. And Yosef says, I can't believe you. Avraham was told not that many years ago that what's going to happen eventually? What's going to happen? We're going to be kicked out somewhere and we need to prepare for the future. We need to change our profession. We can't be shepherds in Egypt, right? We need to be in the world of agriculture, which is the sheaves in his dream. We need to change. And he's telling them, we need to learn to adapt. And they say to him, "Yosef, what's wrong with you? The present is great. It's happy. We're fine. Leave me alone." And the Rav writes that Yosef, who is right, obviously, between Yosef and his brothers? Yosef! Who's the only one that saves Egypt later? Yosef! Because he said, you got to learn to adapt. And the Rav says that Yosef, if you look to page 11, the Yosef, the Rav says in the top left, the Yosef of 5662, the Mizrahi, was as the one who prophesies and does not know what he prophesies. He agreed with his great brothers that the future is viewed only in the present. There's no justification for joining the so-called free thinkers. But the Yosef of 5662, that's early Zionism. They're not a dark foreboding of something terrifying. An apocryphal vision of catastrophe, cataclysm, tempest, imminent destruction, although you cannot verbalize it in grammatical sentences. The Yosef of 5662 felt those very Jewish cities of Brisk and Minsk and Vilna and Warsaw, with their houses of study and yeshiva and effervescent religious life, would be first to succumb to secularism. So what does the Yosef then do? He moves to Israel and he settles. And you know what they did to that Yosef? What do the brothers do to Yosef? They mock him, they laugh at him. And look at the right side. The Rav says, I would like to ask a simple question. What would the Yeshiva and Torah scholars rescued from the Holocaust, these burning embers taken from the friar, have done if the Yosef of 5662 had not trod a path for them in the land of Israel? Just like Rav Kook. There was something extraordinary that they did in the late 1800s, early 1900s. We didn't know what it was. And we yelled at them and we screamed at them. Not we. They were yelled at and screamed at. But we said, this is the right thing. And had they not been there, where would have these places, where would they have gone after 1945? And then I'll come back all the way to, I know we're already wrapping up. So I'll come back to what I started with in the beginning. So they asked me, right, what do you do on a Yom HaAtzmaut? So when I finally saw the thing that I quoted for you last, that's what I tell people in interviews. For Moshe Lichtenstein, and I'm going to summarize an absolutely unbelievable essay. You should read it on your own. I can send you the link later. He suggests the following. And this is where we are today. We only have two rabbinical holidays. What are they? Why? Because great miracles happen, right? It's not true. Why? There's a lot of great miracles in Jewish history. We don't celebrate them. What did Chazal see in these two holidays? They didn't see miracles. They saw those two moments in Jewish history when we thought it was a good run. We had a good run with God, but it's over. Hanukkah is the first secular, we'll start with Purim. Purim was the first time Jews were in exile, told they could go home. You know what they did? They stayed. And you know what we thought when Ahaman came and tried to kill us? All right, we didn't go back. It's our fault. All right, we lasted this long. We had a good run with it. So God gives us a miracle to tell us what? I'm still here. You're still mine. That covenant is never going to break. And then we had Hanukkah. For the first time in history, what happened? We were completely Hellenized. And we thought, all right, we had a good run with the Torah, but we found something equal. And we completely assimilated religiously. And we thought it was over. And what does God do? Gives us a miracle. Hey, you're still mine. And for the rest of Jewish history, those two moments were enough to get us through until the Holocaust. After the Holocaust, in 1945, we looked back, right? In all of the light of what should be included in a Holocaust statement from the White House, and what shouldn't be included in a Holocaust statement. We looked back and we looked at 6 million Jews that were dead. And we looked at Torah centers that were wiped out. And we looked at Gedolim, and we looked at families, and we said, all right, we had a good run. So what does God do? So he gives us the state of Israel. And he says, I'm still here. And Rav Moshe Lichtenstein writes so beautifully, when people fighting for Gush Etzion are fighting in the pajamas that they had from the Holocaust, when they could have settled anywhere in the world and just said, I'm done with everything, they went to Israel, they fought for the land of Israel. That's because God says, I'm not giving up on you. And that's really how I look at it. We don't believe in the anti-Zionism belief. We don't believe that we don't do anything. We don't sit back. And we don't also believe that because we did something, we got the redemption. But we believe that it's our goal to work and to work and to work and to be involved and to be involved in the land of Israel and its growth and in the growth of the Jewish communities there and the growth of Jewish communities everywhere. That's the goal towards redemption. Is it Mashiach? Is it not Mashiach? I don't know. It's the beginning of something. It's better than being the beginning of nothing. And that path, says Rav Tzvi Yehuda, when we answer that call and we say, yeah, we're listening, we're going up, we're being involved, that's answering the call of God. That's an enormous responsibility. It's like Rav Amital used to say about Yom HaAtzmaut. Right, people used to ask him, Hallel, no Hallel. He says, just don't say Hallel, say Tehillim. But recognize what an amazing gift. What an amazing opportunity we have. And that gift we got in 1948, that goes all the way back to Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer in the middle 1800s, saying, we're going to go, we're going to be involved, because la'at la'at, kimma kimma, the redemption happens. And we believe in that. We do believe that ultimately we will become a redemption, but we're at least involved in that process along the way. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Rabbi Eisenberg.